Much Ado About Nothing. This is one of the most popular of Shakespeare's plays at Key Stage 3. That's the time for national tests taken at 14. Supported by funding from Deutsche Bank, Shakespeare's Globe has mounted a special production which is being attended free by 6,000 young people this week. The Department for Education and Skills, with whom the Globe has been working to help teachers tackle Shakespeare in the classroom, has arranged for a live recording to be available free in MP3 format from the DFES website. My name is Heather Neal. I am at the Globe now, and here to talk to Theatre Voice about this ambitious project is Joe Howarth, the director of this production. Joe, this is an unusual production. Have you gone about it differently? Because you have an audience of almost exclusively, not completely exclusively, but almost exclusively much younger people than you would normally get in a complete audience, even at the Globe.
Yeah, I have. In some ways I have. I have in that I've cut it down, having a 6,000 14-year-olds coming and 1,500 at a time. I wanted to cut it down to an hour and a half, partly at the Globe because so we didn't have to have an interval. The logistics of getting on a possibly freezing cold or wet March day, of getting kids out and back again, seemed unnecessary. But also just kind of cut it down, really kind of cut it down to the action. So there's nothing, there's no spare meat on it at all. It's sort of treat after treat, was the idea, really. So editing it down. I suppose that shaped it is partly because they're young people, partly because it could have been cold or soaking wet. Actually, well, it was wet yesterday, but it hasn't been too cold, thankfully. But yeah, they were the sort of my main thrust in the way I approached it. Oh, and having 10 actors rather than a kind of complete cast as well, so that helped. So we needed to edit it down because of that too.
Yes, you mentioned the weather. The weather's a character at the Globe anyway, but the real season, the season proper, I should say, doesn't start until May. So how have you managed to counter the possibilities of cold, wintry South London weather? Because this is meant to be set in warm Sicily, isn't it?
Yes, I guess it is. Well, that was the first thing that we decided not to do, is that when we looked at it, that became our first design idea, was to place it somewhere cold and sort of, you know, North European. So, I mean, the first ideas for design were having lots of fires and fur coats and that sort of thing, so at least the actors kept warm, and if they were warm then the audience might feel warmer too. As it is, we haven't got that much fur in it now. We've got a little bit. We've got one big brazier that happens somewhere, but we've gone for that, which is fine, actually. I mean, it's interesting that when you really look at the text, because you always presume, I think the kids will, because a lot of them will know the play through the Kenneth Branagh film, will imagine it one way, and actually I kind of purposefully wanted to go against that, because it's really good for them to see something else. You know, it's so often if you've only seen one film of it, that's the way that children imagine it is. To kind of show them something different, so we've gone for...
Yes, that's always a difficulty, isn't it? Mm. Children tend to think that there is only one way of doing it.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting for them to see different approaches. People think of this play as being sort of the Beatrice and Benedict play, but actually they are in fact, the subplot, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got the Claudio and Hero story, which only works if you believe in a rather draconian honour code. How have you gone about that? Have you set it somewhere very specific for that, or how are we to believe in it?
No, we haven't really. I mean, our world, I suppose, doesn't exist. In a way, I mean, our world is a multicultural, cold world. but as far as that's concerned, I mean, it's interesting because it's actually... you know, in multicultural London, it's amazing how often, you know, I mean, you hear about honour killings. I mean, in London, it's not something that's unheard of, that honour code. Now, we haven't stuck it in a place like that, but it's interesting that you kind of, how likeable Leonardo and Claudio can be, but that shift in them, how many times, and I've talked to children about it as well, how understandable they seem to, you know, they accept it in those characters. It was interesting today, actually. Some of the girls at the front really took against Leonardo.
Because he believed so quickly about his daughter.
It's interesting, yeah. I'm not quite sure what it was. I mean, and actually, thinking about it afterwards, I mean, they took against him as an actor because when he spoke, some spit came out of his mouth. But other actors were doing that, as happens, you know, when you're going at something full pelt, that happens sometimes. And they were fine. It was just that you could tell they'd really taken against him. I mean, it was in the wedding scene. It was fascinating that they just kind of accepted that that's what he was and that he'd gone too far. So saying that, I haven't yes, I mean, it is a world of its own, but it's not a world we've gone, all right, we're going to set it in this, you know, we're going to set it here. We've sort of set it in a place like London, and in London there are families where an honour code is strong enough for people to kill for it.
Yeah. Yes, women have a fairly dreadful time in this society, the society of the play, don't they? They don't have much freedom or much possibility of life unless they marry the right person.
Mm.
So that line, the hardest line in the play, is probably when Beatrice says to Benedick, kill Claudio.
Yes.
But I've seen whole audiences fall about laughing. How does that go down here, and how do you set about rehearsing it?
We've rehearsed it from finding a point of truth for it, really. I mean, to be honest, we've done that without necessarily thinking what the response is going to be. We've done three performances. Well, the first one was a dress rehearsal, public dress rehearsal, which was a mainly adult audience, and they laughed. The second one yesterday, the kids were so excited because just before she says kill Claudio, Beatrice and Benedick get together for the first time and actually say they love each other. The kids were so excited that they said they loved each other and were making so much noise about that, I don't think they heard kill Claudio. And today, we took that into account, that they get so excited about them getting together, that Beatrice turned out and said kill Claudio right out to the audience, and they all heard it, and it was just silence. Which was fascinating, actually. So we've had three completely different responses so far.
Yes, and you don't know, of course, how much your audience knows about the play already, and presumably it differs from group to group.
Yeah, I mean, they're all studying it, because they're all coming because they're doing it for SATs. Yeah. But
some may not have started.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Some may not have started, and some may know more than others. Some may have only studied the two scenes that they're doing for SATs. So, no, I don't know.
Well, you need a good pair to do Beatrice and Benedict, and presumably you've got a good pair. Do you think, or do your actors act, that these two have really missed each other? Because they've had a relationship before, haven't they?
Yeah.
And the flirtation and the mockery is really just a way of covering up their attraction to each other.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we've kind of played it that they've both hurt each other. Benedict particularly has hurt Beatrice. So that game has come from exactly that actually really deep down they both still love each other, but they both hurt each other, and there's a defence that they put up. So much of what we looked at is looking at teenage relationships, because it's so like teenage relationships.
And you have a young cast, haven't you?
Yeah, they were saying that Beatrice and Benedict are actually in their 30s, most of the others, Claudio and Hero, are in their early 20s. Actually, Claudio's probably a bit older than that, but looks younger. but they, yeah, no, it is a young cast. And so hopefully of an age where the students watching it can kind of relate to what they're going through.
Mm.
And a lot of what we looked at. And also in Claudio getting upset about thinking that Hero's gone with somebody else. You know, it's something that teenagers go through as well all the time, that thing about faith or not, or you know, it's
he does believe awfully quickly bad things about her.
Yeah, he does, but I think teenagers can do that sometimes, you know, when it's your first relationship and you haven't got much self-confidence.
Mm.
You know, and a lot of that is about self-confidence, and I don't think Claudio has got, he's confident in himself as a soldier, but he's never dabbled in girlfriends before, and you know, how many of the boys that I saw out there today were in exactly that situation. And the first time a teenage boy falls in love, but then, you know, and if you haven't much self-confidence, then you're very readily going to be able to believe that it's all gone horribly wrong. Mm.
Does that account for Claudio allowing Don Pedro to woo on his behalf? Because that always seems a rather odd thing to be.
Yeah. No, I mean, we've definitely thought that actually he's got no faith. But also, we have a very boisterous Don Pedro who loves to have a bit of fun and who sort of takes Claudio along with him without Claudio really having said yes, because he doesn't really say yes. He just goes along with it.
Mm.
But we've definitely gone down that line with Claudio, that he's just not confident with girls and hasn't.
So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas Don John, who sets up the plot, of course, and gets everybody believing that Hero has been unfaithful, although all she's done really is talk through a window.
Yeah.
But what are his motivations? Is he simply jealous of other people's success?
We've had a lot of talk about that with our Don John. Partly, again, I think it's another love story gone wrong. I think without Don Pedro and Don John, that Don John has a huge affection for his brother, but feels left out by him. That is bitter because his brother's got everything as far as, you know, but because he's a bastard, by the fortune of birth, he gets nothing. That sort of started embittering him. But he's... Yeah, but it's, yeah, we have built up that there's actually a big affection between these two brothers, but Don John is kind of, he's jealous, really. There's a kind of jealousy of his brother that just means that he doesn't want to join in.
Mm. And he's not really reformed at the end, is he?
No. No, well, he goes away and becomes a sexton in our production. But, no, he comes back. Well, of course, like all Globe shows, we end with a big jig. And in the jig, good. The two brothers dance together.
Claudio, though, does seem a rather shallow to me. It's always a bit sort of disappointing, really, that does he learn? Because, I mean, he's willing to accept somebody who merely looks like Hero at the end, doesn't he? Because he doesn't know that she's still alive.
No, he doesn't. We have our masked women that come in at the end. Is that we decided that it's also because it's women directing it, I'm sure. But that rather than what often you see is when the three masked women come in, like three beautiful brides turn up, and he's got to choose which one, or you know, and he's given one of them. We thought that was kind of pretty unlikely, and actually, what you want to do is punish him. So we have three revolting old hags turning up, and he has his punishment of having to choose one of these extraordinary.
Oh,
hags.
Very medieval, really.
Yeah, yeah. And that so he's kind of put in his place, rather, that he has to choose one, and that he does learn. I mean, and they're hags that are desperately trying to be sexy. So there's a kind of weird thing about.
But are they in on the joke as well?
Well, it's Beatrice, Margaret. And,
oh, I see. Of course,
Beatrice, Margaret, yeah. And Hero in their masks, you know. But it's a sort of we just felt that he needed a bit of punishing rather than bringing. You know, what is the whole thing about the three masked people coming in? You know, what's that? But it's part of again. You know, Leonardo's another person who likes to set up a good jape, the same way as Don Pedro does. That it's part of that, or Hero organising it for herself. So. I think in ours we do try and teach Claudio a lesson, and he's given a punishment from which he accepts absolutely because of what he's done, and then is completely joyful when he sees that it's Hero. But we've also kind of added a little bit that Shakespeare probably hasn't quite put in here because he didn't exactly overwrite Hero, is that, no. That she chooses whether to go ahead with it or not. So she comes and reads the note that Claudio leaves on her tomb. She reads it out and then screws it up and decides not to do it and then changes her mind and says yes, she will. Uh-huh. And her and her father hug. Yeah. And
watch for this appearing in exam question.
Yeah, well, no, but it's interesting. I mean, it's kind of one of those things that I suppose we were looking at it going, there's the bit missing here, and the bit that we find hard isn't so much her getting back and forgiving Claudio, it was forgiving her father for saying she, you know, and that is just skipped over by Shakespeare, and is just as well, you know, it's not even talked about. And I kind of think to a bunch of inner city young teenage women, we wanted to make that kind of clear that what happened there. So we have a little moment of reconciliation.
Whereas Beatrice, of course, has plenty of fire and plenty of personality, but you could say it very nearly prevents her getting marriage, which would have been her only way out, because presumably she's a sort of poor relation in Leonardo's household. Do you see her like that?
Well, no, we were actually thinking cousin? That she may have money. Actually, we were wondering whether her ability to speak her mind actually came from the confidence of knowing that she's got some money, because it's a wealthy household, Leonardo's household. I mean, he talks about when he says to Claudio, he offers Hero and his fortune, and Claudio says, "Take myself." So Claudio obviously has nothing apart from him. So it's a household with money. So we actually thought there's no reason why Beatrice, part of Beatrice's ability to say no to the prince, and to be able to speak her mind and not be a sort of chained woman, is the fact that she could have money behind her. I mean, in a way, that's the only thing at that time which would have given her that strength. So I see no reason why she hasn't got her own money, but maybe no family. So living with Leonardo as her closest family is the household that she can feel comfortable in.
But she and Benedict maybe are on their last chance of finding somebody before they're considered terribly old in their society.
No, you do get though of course for her, but not for Benedict. Cause
men
can get married at whatever time, can't they?
But as long as they've got a bit of money, presumably.
Exactly. Which he may or may not have done. So you do get the feeling it's sort of last chance with her, but she's got a kind of feistiness that you sort of think she'd manage somehow without, but there'd be a kind of a part of her that would be lost. I mean, what you do get the feeling, and I think there is that thing in that play about when people are true to themselves and when they're covering up with cleverness or wit or and again, I think that's something that teenagers will understand. I think about when you're kind of being witty to actually cover up real feelings. And when it's real, and there is something lovely that the children recognise, and they've recognised again today. And why they got so excited when Beatrice and Benedict got together, I think, is those moments when they can be honest with each other, and that there's something, they grow in that. And I think the children recognise that.
The people who save the day, of course, are the very strange and incompetent watch led by Dogberry. Which is often quite difficult to make funny for a modern audience.
Yes.
Have you cut them a lot, or what? Have you managed to deal with that? Because I think adults will do a bit of sighing sometimes during the Dogberry scenes, but children, presumably, you can't hold their attention for too long without something happening.
Yeah, well, we have cut him, but then, to be honest, we've cut down to an hour and a half. We've probably cut him no more than anybody else.
So your cuts are throughout, are they? Trims rather than whole scene?
Yeah, I mean, we've cut Antonio completely, and we cut Comrade completely, and we cut Ursula completely. Though, saying that, Margaret is now a combination of Ursula and Margaret, and Baraccio is a combination of Comrade and Baraccio. But so they're kind of big chunk. So there are big chunks of Antonio that have gone.
So when you've trimmed, have you gone for the main? Obviously, you have to go for the jokes that relate to the plot, but not all the malapropisms, presumably.
No. And actually, they love listening to it yesterday and today. They love it when he says, "I'm an ass." All the ass stuff, the kids adore. So that stayed in. Some of the malapropisms they haven't quite got, however, the adult audience on Saturday got a lot of them. To be honest, we've changed a couple of them to make them words that other people have found funny. Vagrant has become fragrant men. But so we've done a tiny bit of that. No, it's been trimmed down, but it's also become very physical as well. And the watch we bring out of the audience, so the watcher actually standing in the audience, and so he's talking right out to all the audience as if they're part of the watch as well, so it kind of engages them in it too. Verge is his Caribbean partner, who the kids have completely find hysterical. We've had the last 2 days has been very funny. I think obviously she reminds them of their mothers or something. It's just they just get hysterical when she speaks. It's quite funny. So the kind of combination of also we've got them catching Baraccio. We have a huge chase that goes throughout the whole theatre with whistles blowing and the kids trying to catch him and everything. So we've sort of linked into the kind of the physical side of it. And trimmed it down a bit as well.
Well, the title, of course, Much Ado About Nothing, or noting, apparently, an Elizabethan would have said, and it might be a dirty joke. I mean, does any of that, well, I suppose it goes through your mind in rehearsals, but maybe it doesn't come out in the performances.
Well, it's in the play, I mean, it is. The whole thing is about this. The whole thing is about people overhearing things, and overhearing for good or overhearing for bad, there's so much of that. And it was interesting, actually, we did take out, because you become aware there's a lot of things of people overhearing something or somebody being told something that they, like for Beatrice and Benedict about, on purpose.
They're set up, their friends make out that the other has.
Yeah, they think they've overheard something and actually they've been set up to overhear it. So there's all those things, which actually does make you have to be clear about those times where people have heard things and when they haven't. Because we did have a moment where we had Claudio after he thinks Don Pedro has taken Hero from him at the party. Actually just sitting out in the yard sulking. But what we realised is that the audience watching him might think that he can overhear the next bit of the scene, and would affect the way he is. So we've now got rid of that bit because we realised we had to be clear about the things people overhear and the things they don't. And we were also thinking about putting in the window scene, which Shakespeare doesn't, of Borachio going up to Margaret, and partly because we thought it would be fun and quite a laugh for the kids that we could put that in. And in the end, that's had to go because of time and doubling, to be quite honest, with the Margaret character has to get around and be Virgie straight away. But to be honest, it's interesting because I also think I was thinking about putting it in because I didn't trust the kids would really listen to the story of actually what was happening, because you have to listen to all these people saying this is what the trick's going to be, and Margaret with Borachio saying that, you know, he's going to pretend to be Claudia, pretend that Hero's Margaret and all the rest of it. And it, and actually, I thought, no, I've just got to trust that the audience are going to listen to that, because Shakespeare trusts they're going to listen.
And they have been.
I think so. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be any problem with them not doing. We do have Borachio, when he's telling the story of what he's just done, just coming down from the window and doing his flies up. So that just sort of helped slightly for those that hadn't quite picked it up. But that something's gone on. Yeah. But no, I think they have got it. Yeah.
So have you enjoyed doing it? This is the first time you've directed on the Globe stage, hasn't it? Which is a challenge, isn't it? There's nowhere to hide there.
No.
Have you enjoyed it?
I've loved it. I've absolutely loved it. And it is a stage I know better than any other. Because
you've acted.
I've acted on it, and I've directed a lot of student scene studies on that stage, but never a whole play. So I've kind of played with the space a lot over the last 10 years or more, you know, since it's been built, so just over 10 years. So it's a space that I love, and a space that answers questions. It's amazing that you can work on any Shakespeare text in the rehearsal room, and you know, you come up with kind of questions and things that don't quite work, and you go out there into that space and it answers the questions for you. You know, you can stage something in that space, suddenly lines work that didn't work when you read them or when you did them in the rehearsal room. Because suddenly it makes sense that, of course, you're doing that up to the gods. Or, you know, of course, that one you use the pillar for, and suddenly things make sense. So it's exciting for that reason, working on that stage.
And very exciting for all those children to see it.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yes. Thank you very much, Jo.
Thank you.